U.S. and global fertility rates have been in decline for years, and the COVID-19 pandemic has amplified this trend. Birth rates are tied to several global issues, including healthcare, climate change, immigration, and economics. What do these trends mean for women, the elderly, and for caregivers? I'm Sarah Barnes, and you're listening to Friday Podcasts, hosted by the Wilson Center's Maternal Health Initiative. In today's podcast, we bring you excerpts from our recent event, Baby Bust, the impact of COVID-19 on declining fertility rates. In these segments, we feature Natasha Brahman. Natasha is EMU Serrano's Director of Global Government and Public Affairs for Fertility. In this capacity, she is responsible for relationships with governments, civil society stakeholders, and patient groups, and works to broaden awareness and treatment access for those facing infertility. She is particularly interested in how demographic trends intersect with gender norms and societal notions of family building. This episode of Friday Podcast was made possible through the generous support of EMD Serrano, the healthcare business of Merck KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany. In Natasha's opening remarks, she discusses how COVID-19 will have ripple effects on people's desire and willingness to have children. She also presents data on how fertility rates were impacted by the economic crises in the 2000s in Europe and what we can learn from the lasting impacts.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here. Obviously, the topic of low birth rates, of declining fertility, and of COVID is an enormous one. We could be here for days talking about it. So I want to focus on one aspect that comes at the beginning of all of this, the decision to have a child or not to have a child. This decision is obviously intensely personal. When made in aggregate by millions of times, by millions of couples, it can have huge implications, which is why we're here today talking about it. Now, one thing to remember is that most people, when asked in surveys, say they want to have children. In fact, they want to have more than one child. See the ideal number of children in the EU and Japan, that's about 2. It's closer to 3 for US respondents. People end up having fewer children than they say they consider ideal. Now, this data is from before COVID. So this gap between the ideal and the actual number of children was already there. And we can talk about why this gap exists, but it's something that is not unique to the COVID situation. Now, what factors influence the family building decision? Obviously, a big one is the desire for a child. And we have seen that usually this is there. Then another big one is academic, professional, personal ambitions. Basically, what does a person want to achieve? What does a person want to do before they have children? This could be completing a degree, getting started on a career. People have plans for their lives that they want to do before they have children. And so, you know, having reached those goals or not having reached those goals factors into the decision of having a child. Another big one, relationship status. So the question of, am I in a stable relationship? Depending on culture or personal preferences, this question would be, am I married? Have I found someone to raise this child with? Because after all, most of us don't aspire to be single parents. So this part definitely has been impacted by COVID. Weddings have been postponed, dating was more difficult. A lot of those markers of relationship maturity have been put on hold. And I suspect that we'll see the ripple effects of that over the coming years. The data we're looking at now is for 2020. Those were decisions made at the very beginning of the pandemic, whether or not to have a child. So if your wedding was postponed in July of last year, that doesn't even factor into what we're seeing now in terms of birth rates. That will come later. And again, I suspect that we'll see the ripple effects of the COVID impact on relationship status maturity in the coming years. And finally, a big factor that influences decision-making for children is financial situation. So the question of, can I provide for this child in a manner, in a way that I consider adequate? In essence, the decision for a child usually requires a feeling of stability, a feeling of confidence in the future, And again, this is where COVID comes in. Especially in the first months of the pandemic, there was no feeling of stability. No one knew what was going to happen. It was a genuinely scary time for many people. Let's remember that. So I thought at the time the jokes about lockdown babies were a bit misplaced because people were scared. And people genuinely don't feel it's a good time to have kids if they're scared about the future. So this COVID baby bust that we're discussing today was unsurprising based on some past data. What I mean by that is that we can look at past situations, we can look at past crises to add additional context to analyze what's going on with COVID. This graph shows the birth rates in Italy, Spain, and Greece between 2000 and 2018. Before the financial crisis, you can see the rates were fairly stable or they were even going up. And then they dropped when the financial crisis hit, and they dropped even further during the Eurozone crisis. And remember, those three countries were particularly hard hit by the Eurozone crisis. Those birth rates have never recovered. The GDPs of those countries have recovered, the birth rates have not. Spoiler alert, COVID made it even worse. Italy had the lowest birth rate in 2020 since they started keeping records in 1861. So again, COVID didn't exactly improve the situation. So in those three countries and with those two crises, a large part of the cause of the drop was the fact that the crises had an outsized impact on young people. There was huge youth unemployment, high job insecurity, people leaving university just couldn't find jobs. And, you know, to a large extent, there were also policy decisions that favored older workers over younger workers. Not saying those were wrong, but they certainly had ripple effects that no one had anticipated. Down to the fact of changing the birth rates for entire countries. Will COVID look like this? Will this be the effect of COVID? We don't know. Young people are, again, most impacted by financial uncertainty. So this is certainly something that we're seeing again with COVID, but it will depend on how the recovery is shaped, how the recovery is distributed, what the impact of the distribution between generations will be. So there's lots to talk about. I'm happy to be here and I'll stop there. Thank you.
In this segment, Natasha presents some of the barriers people face in having more children. What is the role of women's empowerment in increasing freedom of choice when it comes to fertility rates?
There's so much to unpack here. So let's start with the general trends before COVID. For the past few decades, women have spent more time in education. They've spent more time climbing the ladder at work, so to speak. So, you know, achieving educational and job goals. And that has contributed to factors like later marriage, delayed childbearing, all of which has contributed to driving down birth rates in, you know, countries across the globe. So, you know, I don't think anyone would stand up and say it's a bad thing that women are getting more education or that they're working. It's simply been a side effect that has led to additional sort of decrease in birth rates. Now, let's keep in mind that in many countries, the dual income couple has become the norm and has actually become a requirement to live in urban areas. That in many cities, not just in the US, but around the world, rents are sky high, the cost of living is very high. So even just to finance, you know, you living in a city, you probably need two incomes. And then, you know, the question comes, how many children can you add to that calculation? Do you need more space? If so, can you afford for one person to leave their job? Probably not. So, you know, this is a calculation that couples clear across the world have to make of living standards versus childbearing choices. And so I wouldn't even say that it's women living their best lives that leads to low birth rates, although that certainly contributes to women having more freedom of choice. But I would say that there are other factors that I've mentioned, you know, financial struggles, personal attainment goals or educational goals that people want to reach, that all contribute to delayed marriage or delayed childbearing decisions that overall, it, again, when taken in aggregate, lead to lower fertility rates.
Now, Natasha touches on the important discussion of the role of immigration and political will in counteracting low fertility rates.
So I think one of the things that we forget in this discussion is that looking at the differences between countries in different regions, in this case, Europe and East Asia. If you look at Germany, for example, Germany has had a birth of fertility rate of about 1.4, 1.5 since the 1970s. So we've been at that very low level, you know, for decades. We've staved off the effects through immigration. Now, this has happened to a much lesser degree in Japan and Korea and other East Asian countries because it's simply less politically palatable. So I think there's a real difference here in looking at the impending effects of aging that will hit those countries very differently. One thing I do want to mention, especially when it comes to policymaking, is that many of the countries that we're talking about are fortunately democracies. And the people who vote for whatever policies get enacted are increasingly old. So the question of how funds get distributed, what kind of decisions get made, what kind of priorities are set, are increasingly skewed towards supporting an older population, which is perfectly understandable, it's perfectly fine. But it means there are trade-offs, especially in reduced budget situations, that can lead to a spiral where you have, you know, less funds available for young people, for young families, and it becomes a self-perpetuating pattern. So, you know, that's in one part, that's how democracy works. But let's keep in mind that the people who vote are increasingly old in lots of countries around the world.
How do we create policies to boost fertility rates without running pro-natalist policies? Natasha talks about the importance of reducing the barriers that prevent people from having as many children as they would want to have.
Sure. And I think we should draw the distinction between encouraging people to have children. So, you know, whether that's giving them money or running ads, you know, promoting childbearing, and removing barriers to the choices that people might want to make in regards to having children. So those are slightly different nuances on this issue. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that people say they want to have more children than they end up having. And a lot of that is due to these kinds of barriers. A large part of it is also aging. People start later, so they end up having fewer children overall. So age is a huge part. But there are these barriers of combining work and family life, combining work and caring responsibilities. And if you look at those countries where the gap between the ideal number of children and the actual number of children is fairly low, so countries like France, you see countries that have a very robust and well-funded government system of providing daycare, of providing elderly care. It's not perfect by any stretch, but there are provisions in place for parental leave. There are provisions of, you know, people being able to make choices without being afraid that they will lose their job, that they will lose their home. And so it's perhaps less about, you know, running pro-natalist policies specifically, and more about removing barriers for people's choices that they might want to make for their life planning. In terms of, you mentioned funding for assisted reproduction, that is certainly a path that countries, especially in Europe, have taken, where ART, so assisted reproductive technologies, are in many cases funded by the healthcare system. There is obviously, for those people experiencing infertility, and let's remember that's about one in six couples, that is a huge deal. You know, the fact that you don't have to suffer infertility without assistance is a big deal for those patients affected. Does it impact fertility rates? Well, I would say it depends on the country and how well funded and how well accepted these methods are. I'll give you the example of Denmark, which funds IVF fairly generously, and where about 8% of each year's cohort is born through medically assisted reproduction. So would none of those 8% have been born otherwise? Well, you know, that's something we can certainly discuss, but 8% is born through medically assisted reproduction. And that's a pretty big part of each year's birth cohort. So I'll stop there.
Some argue that low fertility rates are actually a good thing due to the increasing strain of a growing population on the environment. Here, Natasha talks about the reality of the bigger environmental picture and how fertility rates contribute.
I would also say that let's look at where populations are still growing and where they're, you know, stagnating or shrinking. And if you look globally, you have a situation where over the next decades, the biggest growth will come from sub-Saharan Africa because their populations are young. You have a number of countries that still have a fairly high fertility rate. And so over the rest of the century, these countries will continue to grow. And there are some estimates that actually Nigeria will become the most populous country on the planet by the end of the century. At the same time, you have in Asia a huge disparity between East Asia with falling populations in many countries, and South Asia with still growing populations, and they will continue to grow in the next couple of decades and then level off as populations age. Latin America, Europe shrinking, US kind of stable. So we'll see the global population actually start to fall by the end of the century. So I would say, you know, looking over the last 70 years, we've seen a lot more growth in the global population than we will see over the next 70 years. So that doesn't make our footprint on this earth okay. I'm just saying that the population is already leveling off across the world. We now have a global fertility rate of just under 2.5. So we are not at the same exponential population growth that we were at a couple of decades ago. And that's important to remember in terms of the bigger environmental picture. Now, of course, with rising prosperity comes more consumption, a bigger footprint, environmental degradation, loss of ecosystems, loss of biodiversity. Those are all things to consider. And frankly, I think some of the solutions, if you will be in migration over the next decades, as those countries who struggle with maintaining their populations source younger labor, source people from those countries that still have high birth rates or have younger populations. Frankly, I think within my lifetime, we'll probably see a scramble for population, not just a war for talent, but just a war for people, to have people come and migrate to those countries that would otherwise be significantly shrinking.
In our last two segments, Natasha discusses the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on women's access to reproductive health services and what we can expect to see in terms of fertility rates in the coming decade.
One of the, what I found most distressing reports sort of midway through the first lockdown was reports about the difference in access to care in various countries. So the fact that, we're talking about a baby bust in many countries is because of the availability of choice of reproduction in high-income countries. Whereas in many other countries, especially low and middle-income countries, women faced a situation where clinics were closed, NGOs stopped their services. They simply did not have access to contraception, to medical care. And I think we're only just starting to see the effects of that, of higher unintended pregnancies, higher unintended birth in lower income countries. And that is a backsliding of huge progress that's been made over the last years and a really tragic and distressing side effect of the COVID pandemic and the lockdowns that happened. Yeah, probably no baby boom. I would say that those people who already have children or those people who know people who have children basically saw the very fragile construct that many modern families have come crashing down in a very short amount of time. And so I think people who have children are going to think long and hard about having another one. And those people who observed the misery that those families went through are also going to think long and hard. And that goes doubly for, you know, women who were torn between all the different responsibilities that often fell on their shoulders. And I think there's no easy solution to that, but it's going to linger over the next years.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this edition of Friday Podcasts. And thank you to Natasha Brahman and to EMD Serrano for your continued support and partnership. To learn more or to view the event in its entirety, visit the .mom column on newsecuritybeat.org or follow us on Twitter @Wilson_MHI. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Friday Podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts.